So, welcome to episode 12 of A Marriage of Serpents, an Archive adventure. Archive is a dark Bronze Age Celtic adventure world, and A Marriage of Serpents is an adventure that takes place a decade after the tragic events of the God's Fall War and its consequences, ranging from the erosion of the positive virtues of society that were actively supported by the gods of the Night Lodge, now gone, to the death of the dragon, which was the spirit of the land, of Maur, the island on which this adventure takes place. Our heroes begin a decade after that war and in the recovery from its consequences. And drawn together by the perhaps petty wishes of the son of the King of Tuhal, they have embarked on an investigation that has led them into places that none of them could have expected, but that some of them are absolutely willing to follow. And so I will ask our intrepid heroes to introduce themselves, or the players to introduce themselves and the heroes that they're portraying in our adventure this evening.
All right, my name is Matthew Melville, and I am playing Cecile and Sisyphus, the two Surin, or lizard folk, on a mission to find a new homeland for their people.
My name's Dale, and I am playing a rose wandering a labyrinth alone, calling out for its friends.
I am John Scavone. I'm playing Kian Gallagher. He's a Dree wizard that a while ago was involved in some cloak and dagger activities which got him in trouble, and now he's a bonded servant of House Fane, and he's trying to find a way home.
In last week's adventure, episode 11, represented by this card, The Ancient Ones. Our heroes met very unlikely acquaintances down in the dark under the Olu compound in the Clearwater district of the capital city of Tuhal. In the caverns down below, they made peace with a spinner, one of the spider folk, who seems to have been ensorcelled, perhaps by the girl Aya, who went through somehow a builder structure and launched an alternate universe to protect herself and to wrestle with enemies of great power and kind. They met emerging after them and the portal closing behind it to Aya's world, the Tuhal of the Morning, was one of the shades of Thurn, the god of death. And this facet of Thurn being known commonly as the Stranger on the Road, which is a figure in pale robes, often wielding a sickle, a hand sickle, often made of silver, which is an intimation of necromancy and witchcraft and night arts and other things, a silver sickle. The Shadow of Death confronted Kian, but decided or announced that Kian was not the one it was looking for. not the one whose life it existed to claim. And it demanded of the wizard that he open the path more than once and seemed to turn back toward the unlit builder stone as if expecting the wizard to be capable of opening the path, perhaps because it was Kian the wizard and not his alter ego, Kiara, whom he had been or been inside of or something in the Tuhal of the morning, but that in the dry wood that they had escaped from, it was Kiara who became Kian again, and it was Kian's power with the breath of the serpent that opened the way for them out of the dry wood and paved their escape. They also encountered the shadow that had warned them when they first entered to all the morning not to get caught up in the story, lest they be lost forever. This shadow perhaps escaped, or perhaps was, there are more than one shadow, is clearly a man with some accoutrements to make him look like an ant with antennae and strangely faceted eyes. But this shadow was, in fact, it wasn't the cunning disguise of some wizard with a power Kian had never witnessed before. It was, in fact, literally a shadow. Perhaps this being's shadow itself, given its own intelligence or borrowing the intelligence of the real person. It identified itself in several ways, but claimed that its name was essentially the Hound, and that it was from a land far across the sea, as Cecile's alter ego was in the monk inside To Hall of the Morning, and claimed that he had come with or followed the kings to Maur, which would make him incalculably old, and that he was both the guardian of the Maur and jailer. In some sense that he didn't fully elaborate on. He told them that there was a vast set of tunnels that this was connected to, that this cavern was connected to, and that down in the center of it was the doorway of terror, to which they had found the capstone up above. And they spoke a little bit about that, and he said that he had been awoken by some power, perhaps by Aya's power, as she interacted with the Builder Stones and made a world for herself, or perhaps something else that involved the terrors locked under the world by the now dead God of Prophecy. And that he had come to the tunnels and sought out the capstone of terror, perhaps on the scent of some power or some sorcery, and that he had become trapped, that his body had become trapped, perhaps in a clever and intentional trap laid at the doorway of terror. There was some discussion back and forth, and he, having gained some trust with one another, Claiborne literally lent him his ear, the shadow of the Hound, to take with him in his investigations into the labyrinths below. Whereupon, the heroes took the boy that had been being safekept by the spinner, wrapped up in a web, and emerging back into the Clearwater District, found the locals had gathered and were whipping themselves up to come in after those terrible people that were clearly in there doing awful things, as evidenced by Cecile's recent destruction and bellowing in saving his companions. Also on their way out, they found that the first room of the Olu Dun had become unlocked, that whatever power had kept it sealed had faded or been canceled, and that the room was open and a baby was wailing within, perhaps a theme for the adventurers. And they had found a woman inside who was presumably the mother of the Olu clan, called Gwyn, dead, with an expression of terror on her face and trying obviously to protect her baby, and locked that way by rigor mortis, and the baby still alive. And they took the baby and the boy, who were identified as siblings of Aya and children of Bandan Olu, the Proving Grounds warrior whose disappearance by magic and perhaps foul play from the Proving Grounds is what ultimately led them to this place. And through some clever application of social skills and bullying, they convinced the crowd to accept them as conquering heroes, which the crowd did, led by their little bully queen, as bullies often are, easily convinced to totally change sides. And then the group dispersed into the night, each on their own path. And so we begin episode 12, Thunder, also in my background. So, what we're going to do at the beginning of this episode, there is a player move that we have not done yet, because we haven't had much of it, called Montage, which is a downtime activity. And this is an offering to the three of you, should you wish to give us a montage, because having parted and gone your own ways, there is a gap of time now in which some of you have clearly gotten up to very particular things, and some of you have not. And so this is the opportunity for each of you, if you would like, to give us a downtime montage. And in addition to being a spectacular opportunity to showcase your character, give us insights into their nature, into their social network, into their experience of Tuhal and Kerkyuval, the capital city in particular. It's also an opportunity for you to work with your characters or work with the story. So if you look at the montage action here, you can see that you can spend your montage. You can give attention to one of your living themes by just telling us some stuff in your life that relates to one of your living pillars, not mythos pillars, that you get up to. So you just sort of return to your normal life and kind of rest in, oh, that was a lot, and now I'm going to be a basket weaver or whatever. You can continue to work the case, so you can spend your evening following down leads, tracing your path back, talking to people, using magic, anything you can dream up to work the case, and you can get some clues. You can explore your mythos, so you can lean into, especially if you last time added some attention or a plus to one of your heroic pillars, or to one of your heroic pillars, you can explore that further and give it another plus. And there will certainly be additional consequences should you choose to go that route. I mean, additional bonuses, obviously. Bonuses. You can prepare for what you think is next. And so you can either like recover, and if any of you had burnt power tags, you could recover that burned power tag. Or you can, based on your description, you can gain 3 juice. And juice are things you can use to either create a tag for yourself or a scene without having to do a change the game move. Or you can use it to give yourself a bonus on an action. You can also recover. So you can heal wounds that you've suffered, Cecile, or you can remove tags, ongoing tags that have been plaguing your character, if you have any of those. Mm-hmm. So that is, after a lot of talking, is what a montage is.
I would like to try and get rid of the toxic burns.
Oh, yes. A montage is not required. And
okay.
If you just don't have it in you this evening, or it's something you want to sort of keep for later, or you just aren't ready for whatever you're thinking, you also can later in the episode engage in a flashback, which is basically a montage after it happened.
Okay.
But it's a little bit diminished, so you'll get less juice or less cues for doing it as a flashback. But you could do it as kind of an interrupt. So that's good.
But is this towards the healing, or is this a separate action kind of thing? Sorry.
So as I said, a flashback is instead of a montage.
Okay.
So if you're just like, I got nothing, or you're like, I kind of have a thing, but it's not really a montage, I'm not ready, or it's not really a montage.
I mean, I've got something if you want something for healing. Happy to do that.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be really clear that you can pick a montage, or if that's really not for you in this moment, you're not losing out. You can claim a flashback as the game goes on, and then you can have done something possibly that you couldn't now predict doing, but that in retrospect, my character went and talked to so-and-so because he, and therefore this person loves me.
Mm.
Or whatever, you know.
Okay.
But just to kind of give you maximum.
If I understood correctly, you were saying that also, like, you can, your healing is not part of that. Like, you can heal for free, and it doesn't mean you don't have to.
Okay, that was kind of my question.
Oh, is that not?
No, healing, you spend your montage healing, and you tell us how it happens.
Okay.
That's the recover from your last activity option of the montage.
Okay. So I think with Cecile, he goes with Sisyphus back to the furnaces area where there's all the ash from all the bodies. They were burning them all. And he's kind of got the part with his arm, and he actually gathers up some of the ash. And then he goes and he finds some soil and a couple other things and a little bit of plant matter. And he builds this kind of poultice. And I think he kind of goes into the dragon dream. Mm-hmm. And he has this conception of him. And he kind of sees his arm, and there's kind of like the radiation of pain and like diseased flesh. And then he sort of has this like conception of himself, but he's a little bit transparent, and they're kind of like sitting across each other, and they're kind of going forward until they sort of meld, and then it's just one, and then it goes back to him, and it's maybe 24 hours of like meditation later, and he sort of just pulls off like the poultice and everything, and it's like good as new.
Very nice.
Can I go next?
Obviously, Sisyphus stood guard over you and cared for
you. Right.
While you were dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
When you awaken, there is some not super fresh squash porridge.
Okay.
Because he knows the hunger will be upon you.
Mm-hmm.
And although it is perhaps not 9 days in the pot, but more than one, and has become quite the porridge. It has some lovely spices in it that sort of delight your senses and seem to sort of help you really wake up back into the world. And as you do, slowly in his way, Sisyphus tells you that he enjoyed the lovely chant that you were making for the last few hours, where you were inviting in the sun and the rain and the seasons, and the way that over and over again, you seem to be saying, come rain, come sun, come seasons what may. And perhaps it's the herbs, but you find yourself suddenly chilled and thinking of the chanting you heard on your way 13 times around the dragon's rib back into Hall of the Morning.
Cool.
Please. And you can mark off that tag.
Cool.
Claiborne walks out into a meadow and stands there for a few days. He has the framework that he has chosen to make himself viably ambulatory and human at a glance, has sustained some impact damage. And he needs to find the white bone of the earth to heal the fissures in his framework. And so, as you all know, horse tails occur in all realities. And so he goes and finds horse tails at the edge of the meadow and learns from them how they pull calcium from the earth and bind it into their own structures to heal and protect themselves. And he finds it easier to remove the broken bones and hold them in his hands to concentrate on them. As he, and so this is what he does. Of course, in order to achieve this, he needs to replace the temporarily absent bone with something else sturdy and of a similar shape. And so he finds living branches, still green and pliable, and uses sections of those to temporarily replace the bones as he mends them. And he finds in their quiet sorrow of severing from their mother tree, he finds a pathway into that song and listens to it for quite a time. And in his dreaming of this green song, he sees himself reaching out to another wound where a suffering friend is infected with an intensity of chemicals. And in this dream, his cool mud hand spreads out across his friend's arms and helps, as the horsetails draw calcium from the earth, helps draw those viciously intense chemicals from his friend's flesh.
John's sitting there like, well, dang, my character's not hurt. What do I do?
Oh, I think we already heard that one. I am going to I'm going to give you a tag for this episode, Dale, called Protected by the Green.
I shall write that down forthwith.
That sounds pleasant.
I think maybe an additional help point for Cecile and Cecile.
Okay. Awesome. He can help me.
And then lastly, I think a juice I'm gonna sort of label as so pick for me. You can have a juice labeled dreaming that you can use for anything that makes sense as the dreaming. Or you can have a juice called the healing hand. Or healing mud.
Oh, those are both so good.
That's why I wanted you to decide.
Yep. Let's use the dreaming juice.
Okay. Lovely. Last and definitely not least, John.
I think in Kian's montage, I'll describe it as a montage. There's a sequence of him, as we ended last session, passionately embracing, perhaps in mortal danger, as he grabs Dreedarg, Aoife, and she does look like she's about to stab him, but then it cuts to them actually together by the hearth. But as they're kind of lying together, Kian, his thoughts keep going to the deck, and when she's not looking at him, he is playing solitaire with the deck over and over and over again, as if trying to find a different outcome. And it's clear we can't see what the result is, but there's some frustration on his face, as it seems like the same result keeps coming up over and over and over again.
Is this maybe like she's like, I'm just picturing like big wolf pelts laid together, yes, in front of the fire, and yeah, she's sort of like wrapped coyly in one of them, passed out.
Yes. Yeah. And I think one of the shots is of the what was the guard
yes,
captain?
Donis.
Donis. Like walking in as Kian is playing cards and next to Aoife's naked body, and she just pours herself a drink and gives him a thumbs up and walks out the door. He's like, really? And because she's been rooting for this for a long time. And then and then there's a shot of Aoife actually kind of seeing the deck and threatening to destroy it with her skin derrick. And there's a big argument.
I'm seeing this as like a montage, almost like, just in my head, I'm seeing like cells of a comic book.
Yes.
A graphic novel.
Yeah, a little bit like that awful, not this idea, but the awful Hulk movie where it's like you see like the scenes kind of coming, like comic book strip kind of things. Yeah. I think you can kind of see it like that.
I was thinking watercolors like the Black Orchid.
Oh yeah, that's better.
You know, like kind of slightly streaky and like obviously recognizable, but kind of like too real, but too kind of blurred away at the same time. Yeah. And I'm just imagining like her with her hand up, obviously with her ski and derrick in it, but instead of like a glowing red blade, there's like a red sun behind her head.
Yes. And I think his hand is on top of the deck, and she can clearly pierce his hand, not kill him, but pierce his hand and destroy the deck. And she seems to be very seriously contemplating just going ahead and doing that. But she doesn't. And then there's a quick kind of cut of scenes of him actually for two different minds resolving the aftermath of the Bandanalu household. He's bringing the alive children to who was Dara's, what was Dara's wife? Tara, and her kind of grief. Did Daru ever come back? I don't know if Daru is in this or not, because we never found him, right?
Yeah.
And like him explaining to her, like having a conversation with her about what happened, and her taking the children and kind of like gesturing, like I'll figure out where to put them. And then it's him alone, like in contrast to that scene of him sharing that moment of companionship by the fire, just alone playing cards with the deck in the house of Bandanalu, and that's his house now because that family's all dead.
And, oh god.
Yeah, and so, and the mother's gone, like the mother, they took the body, but all the other things, the terror, the knotwork and everything is still there. He has left that untouched. And as he's playing cards from the deck, he's kind of recreating the knotwork. Like the kind of layout of the cards coming out. Is he's trying to figure something out.
That's what obsession looks like.
And I'm gonna mark attention on the deck.
As you should.
Are there like bottles of urine next to him, or like?
yeah, that's.
How far gone is he?
That's the second montage. That'll be later. Excellent. So, I think for each of you, there was like a passage of day/days. In there. So some time stretches out. And I'm wondering, so the end of episode 11, the Ancient Ones, the encounter with the Ancient Ones is like, it dispersed you. And one of the actions that reverses dispersion is accretion. And so what is the process of coming back together, and who is the agent of it?
Are you talking to me specifically, or?
I'm just putting that out to the three of you. I'm happy to sweep you all back together, but if somebody wants to do that as a thing, that would be I think also, you know, maybe like highlighting one of your mortal or heroic pillars or just like bringing out for us some piece of your character.
I have a strong feeling whatever brings us together, it is once again unintentional, or at least not deliberate, not consciously deliberate. Much like how we first found each other in this story.
I have an idea.
Okay. I'm open for an idea.
No? Okay. I'll take it. Dale, are you in Slack?
Yes.
Okay.
Ah.
I think all three of us at some point have used a hurt or received a hurt and succeeded. Is that true?
I'm not sure. Maybe if we include to all the morning and et cetera. But that was kind of what we were making up for with the plus and minus.
Cool.
Last time.
Fair enough.
Claiborne appears to Kian, walks into the room and says, "There are some children missing, and I believe that we are the only ones that will bother to find them."
Without kind of even looking up, and uncharacteristically with a bit of an edge to it, he says, "What do you think I'm doing?" As he continues putting cards on the ground, seated right in front of where the mother was dead, on the ground in front of the chair. Not sitting in the chair, but on the ground in front of it.
Mm-hmm. He's sitting at the edge of a complex knot work shadow that you saw when you were here last. But now, in the light of day, it seemed in the night to be like ashes left by the burning of something. But it looks, and perhaps only to you, like it is a shadow being cast by something. It doesn't have the look of a stain or a burn. And you half expect that if you stuck your hand out between Kian and the window, that it would invalidate that part of the knotwork on the floor.
I think you are trying to listen to shadows, and it may be helpful for you to know that a shadow has whispered instructions in my ear. This one, and he points to the side of his head that is smooth and blank and earless.
Ian stops kind of mid play and looks up, giving you his full attention, but silently.
And Claiborne leans forward and says, "You are important, and you must follow me."
Without looking at the card he was about to play, he puts it back in the deck. Mm-hmm. But Claiborne can see it. Kian is looking at the back of it. He puts it back in the deck. Mm-hmm. I suppose.
Temperance, which interestingly looks a great deal like Mahan.
I suppose that's only fair, he says grudgingly. And there's almost as if, like, watching him, there's almost like there's something in the way, like almost like a physical barrier that he breaks through and gathers the cards up into the deck and puts them into his cloak.
I have no idea where Sisyphus and Cecile are. And so I walk directly to them.
I love Claiborne.
I love you too.
Aww.
If you would like to spend the dreaming, you are welcome to do that. If you would like another explanation, I'm happy to provide it.
I think the other explanation might be that I follow the sounds of annoyed gardeners.
Well, Sisyphus
took
is Cecile
all the best melons without even so much as a thank you.
Well, Sisyphus knows the world of men and would do no such thing. Instead, you are in the gray streets under the gray sky. A grand soft day it is, which means the rain is so fine it can barely be seen. You are beset, having been absent for many days, by the children, wearing either daubs of mud on their faces, like clay war paint, or pieces of burlap tied by other pieces of burlap, so that they are brown faced like a Claiborne. And they run up a few at a time saying, you are important and we will follow you. And then they run off madly. Eventually, some of them do scamper along with you for a time as you pass through the new market, almost certainly sealing things as they go. And using you as cover. And it is during that time that you have some small conversation with them, and they tell you that, oh yes, the two Surin, who are one Surin, are at the charnel grounds.
Oh.
And they have been seen there. And the girl who was telling you looks conspiratorially right and left and leans forward, singing.
That song is important. And I will follow that song.
The children, ah! And they go running. This rock is important and I will follow it. Your butt is important and I will swat it.
Oh, good Lord, I've become a meme.
I think you may have just invented memes.
Two kids, stop following me, but you're important, but you're important, but you're important.
That.
And so it is with little delay that you arrive at the edge of the old market on the east side of Tuhal at the burning grounds, where some people and some humans and others who die are either washed and prepared for burial or burned. And the Surin who run the place without any evidence of human supervision.
So I don't think it's Surin. I think it's actually
Wolfen. Oh, is it? The Wolfen. Wolfen.
Yeah.
Oh. Really?
Yeah.
Hang on a second. Okay. Okay, great. Then there's definitely human supervision. yeah. So you enter the charnel grounds, and your entry does not go unnoticed. And a gray, a sort of silver fur Wolfen, wearing a somewhat verdigreed bronze collar comes trotting over and sort of with his tongue hanging out and sort of like bows toward you, Kian.
What service may I do for you today, Master?
He growls submissively. My internet connection, like my mind is unstable. Did you say something?
We're recording again.
That was very exciting.
John went to grab something to drink.
Ah, lovely. Well, why don't we... So the not old but silver-furred Wolfen with the tarnished brass spiky collar, bearing obvious scars at all of the points where the collar has points in his fur, does the the panty bow tikian of the subservient wolfen. And
what can I do for you, master?
He says, sir, obviously, like, trying to look like he's looking around for the body or whatever, and he's just not seeing it.
I kind of flick audibly through the deck of cards and just look over at Claiborne.
The wolfen sort of, as he takes a closer look at Claiborne.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of, his eyes go sort of big and his tongue goes back into his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of nods to you. It's not the bow he gave to you.
After being motionless for several moments and not breathing and not smelling like a living thing, Claiborne moves and says to the Vulfin, we require an audience with our friends, the Thirin.
I'm not certain what you are referring to.
The Wolfen says, betrayed by his obvious glance toward the back of the property, where behind one of the beehive huts that's obviously used to burn bodies, you can see the hulk of Sisyphus's shoulders.
So I think the thing is, if it's during the day, they actually hide. And so, because there's mounds of ash, and they'll actually kind of burrow in. While some humans kind of pass by, and then they kind of come out more at night.
Okay. Then he looks over behind one of the beehives at a pile of ash, and then
it's particularly thick. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kian kind of cocks his head. The Cirin are our friends. Are you trying to protect them for some reason?
The wolfen's lips move as though he's having a short conversation at volumes not meant for your ears. And eventually sort of looking again at Claiborne and going, his nostrils kind of dilating so much they almost sort of come off there. Because, you know, they have the only external or the internal attachment. And the outsides curl around, but they're not actually attached. Mm-hmm. And they flare so much, it looks like they're going to pop off the middle. And you sort of...
There are bones in there, but no meat.
Yeah. And then he looks back at you and clearly reaches a decision and sort of like clenches his hands together, digging his nails into his own flesh. Very uncomfortably looking. Into the obviously rough pads of his hands.
Yes, master.
And he looks at a nearby beehive that's obviously not used to burn bodies. And there's a slate door that's kind of closed over the front of it.
Yes. Yes, master. The Sorin are resting. And if you are their friends, then...
It makes a sort of, like, go fast, but it's something I couldn't possibly say to a human.
Thank you very much for your assistance.
And he sort of backs off to the side... So that he's no longer in front of the two of you, but he's on Claiborne's side.
Are there any human supervisors in sight?
No.
Where we are? Okay. Good.
Now you see a couple of wolfen who are now obviously getting some wood ready for something. They were clearly moving around and they have They seem to have come to a stop and are like restacking pieces of wood while almost looking at you.
As a former spy, Kian is offended.
And I imagine we are being fully smelled.
Kian moves in the direction of the knot beehive.
The knot all that subtly, the silver wolfen moves behind you as you get into, as you flow into motion, Clayborn, and basically it goes across like half the yard, smelling your butt. And then you see like out of the corner of your eye, one of the other wolfen is like, and you hear him peel off from behind you. Yes, this Ashheap is definitely breathing.
Yeah, I think as you approach, Sisyphus just sort of rises up, and it just looks like snow at this point, kind of just cascades down. And then he gets a little shake, which probably gets on both of you. Because it's powdery and there's not much you can do about that. And then you see Cecile, and he's kind of been held, and he's got like the straw to like help him breathe,
like a hollowed out reed.
Yeah. Oh hey, Clayborn,
are you well, my friend?
Well, there's no humans around, present company accepted. So, yeah, we're doing pretty well. How are you guys doing?
I have dreamed long and strangely. And in my dream, a shadow whispered in my ear, this one. And he points to the side of his head, which is smooth and earless. Would you like to know what it said to me?
Of course.
Sisyphus subtly bumps against you, and you follow the point of his snout, and you see a relatively small, kind of straggly brown wolfen who goes by the name Tuft, for the kind of unruly tufts of hair on his head. And he's like dun 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 by the ground, like looking around one of the beehives. Obviously looking at you like, are you okay? Everything okay? Do I need to bite them?
Yeah, I think Cecile kind of just gives him the nod, like.
He kind of sags that a little bit and like pulls back and then peeks around like, I'll be here in case you need me. And just like lays down with his snout in his hands. Sorry to interrupt, please go on.
It said to me, down here in the dark, I have found some that have gone astray. You mentioned that the head of the household from which the sorceress emerged was missing, and perhaps others. There is a place 3 right turns down from the spider's lair and then one turn left, where I have left some sign for you, and where you will find me if you come, I hope.
And do you know who that is, Claiborne?
It is the shadowy person to whom I lent my ear.
The hound, the many-lived servant.
And I suspect he is speaking of those who went looking and lost themselves.
I hope perhaps we can have some good news to bring back to Tara, although I'm rather doubtful.
I too hold hope within my heart.
We shouldn't tarry.
Very well, just hold on a minute. And I think Cecile goes rummaging around like in the ash. He's kind of like throwing some back, and you guys have to like kind of step aside so it doesn't hit you. And then he comes out with like the two kind of like bent and rusty collars and snaps one around him, climbs up and clamps around Sisyphus, who growls at him. He's like, yeah, I know. And gets it tight. Okay.
Oh, you remembered this time. They seem a little small.
Yeah, they've seen better days.
Slave collars are always smaller than they ought to be, aren't they?
Sometimes the one that they're being placed on is growing larger.
Yes.
As you say that, Kian, it occurs to you that there's something that's been itching at your attention, which is Cecile looks taller.
How much time has passed?
A couple days.
And how fast is Sirin age?
Most Sirin are by age 30 are in the range of Sisyphus's size and stop moving.
Oh, wow. Your kind grows fast, Kian says.
Yeah.
Do you feel any different?
Me?
He says, looking at Cecile.
Why? Why would I feel different?
You seem taller than last I saw you.
Really? I hadn't grown for some time. Interesting.
I actually glance over towards Sisyphus. Does Sisyphus make any sort of... Does it just sit there, or does he have any sort of acknowledgement of that?
I think he
is a he.
I think he continues looking the way he was looking, but one of his, but the great eye on your side of his head rolls toward you, and he just nods.
Right. Well, I think we have all everything we need.
So, scene swipe. One moment. (clears throat) And so, after her simultaneously hurried and long-winded explanation, and that's why I think you should not go back into that house, and why we should just close it up and leave it forever, and you should go from this place, forget any of it happened, Dara says, planting her shillelagh firmly in the wet, rocky ground next to the gate, and glaring up at whoever is standing nearby. You didn't really pay that much attention to all the details of it, but there was politics and families and heritage and children and the future and there and, you know.
I'm so glad that somebody is looking after the community, Dara. When the Dree Derrig and I resolve this matter, I'll make sure that she knows how important you've been to our efforts.
Oh, well, that's so then. Now, this would be the second time you've mentioned the Dree Derrig, but we've seen none here. They marshalling their resources.
Well, so actually, just quick flashback. Remember, when I went to Dree Ife, I said, there's something I need to tell you, there's something I need to ask you, and there's something I need to do. Yeah. I saw what he did, and what he asked her to do was to go and check out the house later. Hmm. I don't know if she did or not.
So,
and then what he had to tell her was what happened. So he told her the story.
Oh.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Because I
think that if she had gone, that if you had told her that, she would have gone, and she definitely would have gone down into the underground.
Oh.
And I think you would know that.
That's true. And already with
a being whose shadow walks on of its own accord and who has described itself as the many-lived servant and who claims to be as old as the kingdoms of Maur, trapped by terror down in the maze. Are you sure you set Aoife down in the maze? Just a question.
Yeah.
Oh, you are, really?
No, I'm thinking about it.
So I kind of got from your flashback that was your intent when you arrived, but right. Then upon consulting the cards, you that went sounds, back.
That sounds more likely. Yeah, I think that changed.
Okay.
If your probation officer, you know, goes, we can go on a world-spanning adventure. We can see the sights.
Let's start with the afterlife.
Ankle bracelet off.
After that first night, Aoife turns to Kian. Didn't you say you were going to ask me something or tell me something? Your eyes are so beautiful. And she just punches him in the face.
Walked to a door again.
Lovely.
So what I say to Dara is, we all do our part for Tuhal, and as a bonded, as one who is bonded, he's decided that I'm the one who needs. And he kind of affects a bit of a, this is my burden, my cross to bear, kind of an air.
Oh, I see. Well, and honestly, hasn't this community suffered enough without you inflicting a Dree Derrig on us? She said it in her loud conspiratorial voice.
He leans in and equally conspiratorially says, that was my thought too.
We're practically of one mind, you and I. Except, you know, mine's not full of traitorous things, but other than that. All right, well, she opens the gate. In you go. With your...
And as we head inside, I think, like, Kian kind of taps his nose and looks at Dara and then looks out towards the road, like, you know, like, giving her, like, a keep up the good work, you know, make sure no other louts get in here, like, gives her that kind of a look as he goes inside.
As Sisyphus goes through the gate, he can't quite fit, and there's a little bit of tearing from the boards on both sides as he sort of just gently sort of enlarges the gate. And I think you kind of close the thing, and it doesn't actually, like, close now, but it just sort of swings.
I think as Dara's watching that happen, awkwardly, like, after we've left and we're trying to get to the gate, Kian is, like, awkwardly trying to push Sisyphus, and of course, like, not helping even the slightest bit, considering how heavy Sisyphus is. Just like...
I'd like to push this hill. Well, my back's feeling better.
It becomes clear that someone has generously adopted the farmyard animals that once populated the two side yards of the Alu household. As not only are the animals absent, but a number of their accoutrements, like barrels of feed and half barrels that held rainwater, are also gone.
How generous.
I think I would have given Tara first crack at that, considering I burned it in her with the responsibility of taking care of the kids.
Okay.
Yeah.
She. No.
What?
She would have declined as taking objects from houses of those who have died badly is a good way to get yourself cursed.
Fair enough. She was clearly the smart half.
Just ask her, she'll tell you.
Oh, I'm sure she will.
There has clearly also been some small effort to take the rounded stones of the somewhat collapsed well and use them to, like, weight down the now dying willow tree that has been uprooted and stuffed back in the hole and uprooted and stuffed back in the hole. But it's a deeply solvable problem.
Especially since Sisyphus is here.
Mm-hmm. He points at it like, as if to say, do you want me to do something about that?
Or does one of you want to handle it?
Yeah, so, you know, he just sort of squares his shoulders and just sort of lifts it up, almost gently. Like he's picking up a box. And just sort of shifts it. And then just sort of takes a long hand and sort of gestures.
As we're kind of standing at the cusp of the widening crevice, I think I look over at Claiborne and Kian asks, before you heard from the Hound, have you been listening this entire time? Have you heard things? Has he been carrying your ear with him? Have you heard anything of note?
There have been times when I heard vague sounds, but they did not seem to have import or meaning or intention for me. And I was rather busy on an interior listening of my own.
Th- there are in the gray sunlight streaming down through the opened hole, you can see that there are a few arm lengths below the surface, sort of casual looking tatters of webs. That definitely were not there when you left.
So it looks as if a web has been spun and broken?
Maybe. You don't see webbing lying on the ground, but it's more like there's just some sort of like haphazard looking strung webs that just happen to kind of be difficult to avoid if you wanted to go down the ramp.
Well, we did leave a spinner down there. Can I just also say that since we know what we're going into, we bring lanterns.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
Yeah. We're adequately lighted.
Are these strong enough to stop Sisyphus?
Oh, no. They wouldn't be strong enough to stop Cecile.
Oh, okay.
Doesn't look like.
I think maybe Sisyphus will just kind of go first and sort of clear some of the passageway.
Okay. Eyeing the web, I think Kian says, I think this is less about entrapment and more about alarm. Mm. But it does know us, he says with a light shrug.
Well, it will know Cecile. Or Sisyphus pretty soon.
So Sisyphus,
Cecile asks, since he's going to be up there and there's going to be a lot of webs, can I ride on your back instead? He's kind of going over on his arms.
What were you asking, Kian or Claiborne?
Kian.
On his face with a look that seems clearly not to buy that explanation. He just grudgingly allows you to do so.
There's like a little squeal as he like climbs up. This is nice. You're not so high. Sometimes when I'm riding Sisyphus, like, well, you got to pay attention because he's rarely paying attention. And so, you know, if he ducks under something, you understand.
I think Kian grunts and repeats from earlier, your kind grows fast. He says a little pissed off.
I know, right? Someday I might be too big for this. Look back on these times as like fond memories.
Sisyphus easily sweeps the tattered webs out of the way, and they give an interesting amount of resistance to his hand and then sort of spring away. And you see that there are extremely fine filament strands that were obviously attached to those webs that go off into the deeper dark of the cavern that float slowly down to the ground, not pulling back from a release of tension. Down below, you discover the cavern much as you left it, with the daylight filtering in and the light of your lanterns. I think probably you brought like an oil lantern and a candle lantern, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. The oil lantern's a little bit smoky. So it's nice to have an alternative.
Mm-hmm. I'm very careful not to risk setting any of the web on fire. And I want to ask, refresh my memory, were there any, what bodies were down here? There was the boy and who was alive and we carried out, the baby, And then there was the boy.
The baby was upstairs. The young boy was in the web. And then the sort of half boy, half old man.
Right.
Right.
Was laid across that it? The, but you removed all of them.
Yes. Yeah, there's nobody else.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, the stranger on the road and the shadow of the hound departed under their own power. So the cavern is much as you left it, and you, in the enhanced light that you have, the daylight flooding in and the lanterns, you can see that the cavern is almost like a loaf of badly made brown bread that didn't rise. It's sort of flat and almost completely round and circular, except for the small alcove that is still has a, or that once again has a web across it. And once again, there is something child-sized, webbed up and stuck in the web. And you can see that someone or something has piled the stones and earth that had obviously been knocked out of the, or knocked into the basement of the house. From the edge of the cavern, that's been piled up to mostly cover that hole leading into the basement of the house. And the hallway that leads out of the space to your left that has the half circle of builder stone at its base now doesn't. There is no builder stone in evidence.
Whoa.
And it's just a square cut space that was obviously created. It was squarish before, but with a rounded bottom that was builder stone. The builder stone is now gone, and it's just a perfect doorway in the stone.
Does it look as if the builder stone was never there?
Yes.
Wow.
When the light of the builder stone faded, could we see as it was fading that the builder stone was still there, or did it look like it was disappearing?
No. Okay. It was still there.
Can I use my ability of knowing what passed here to get a sense?
Sure, you can do an investigation. Yeah. So you go over there?
Yeah.
So Kian goes over there?
Sure.
All right. As you approach the doorway, Kian, you have a little, cold hairs on the back of your neck stand up. Like, ooh, just a little whoa, there's something tingly over here.
And I think as that happens, Cecile feels a sudden stop as Kian kind of comes to a sudden stop.
And about the time they stop, as you've kind of moved away from the lantern light, Claiborne.
Yeah.
Your senses drink in more of the dark chamber now that the light has moved away from you. And you can see that the spinner is up in the corner of the ceiling by next to the little alcove where its web is. It's outside the web and kind of up, sort of scloped into the corner where it would be very difficult to notice.
Mm-hmm. I turn towards it and bow slowly. But say nothing.
It's a few of its four limbs cautiously unfurl and sort of tap along the ceiling, but it doesn't do anything else. Its dark eyes are clearly pointed in your direction. So you stop maybe 5 or 6 paces from the doorway. And what are you getting up to?
So I think Cecile kind of wants to leads over Sviss, and then he puts his hand. Yeah, Kian. And then he puts his hand against.
Or is everyone you ride called Sisyphus? Is that a role rather than
right? Name? Right, the Sisyphus versus
you are the Sisyphus.
That feels right.
Yeah, but he puts his hand against the wall, and he wants to try and determine what's past here.
Okay, so as you accommodate Kian, as you accommodate Cecile. And kind of shift to the side, you see you get visual confirmation for a gut instinct or something else. And you can see as the light and shadows shift, that there is a darkness in the doorway, darker than the darkness beyond. And as you raise your lantern, to get a better look at it, the light it throws into the darkness beyond the room clearly outlines sigil characters in the ancient script, written hanging in the air, made of darkness.
Whoa. I'm gonna begin my own investigation, but I'm gonna let Cecile carry out his first.
Great. So, Cecile, you place your hand against the living stone of the wall, and tell us what happened.
So, he concentrates on the stone, and I think he starts to hum. And it's the kind of hum that you get like a little bit of the personal vibration, and he starts kind of vibrating a little bit. And then he's sort of vibrating in tune with the stone. And kind of looking back over, what's happened here over the past couple days kind of thing.
Great. And what tags are you tagging for this?
So that one is the... Oh, what was it called? I had, because I changed it. The
Know what passed here?
Yeah, that one.
Okay. What else? Anything
else? So they have to all be from that one, right?
No.
So I think
youthful curiosity.
Yeah, I think that works as well. So I think those two.
Right. All right. 2d6 plus 2.
Paul, does Sense Death's hand work here?
I wasn't going to suggest that, John.
That would be telling.
Well, Death was literally here, so I don't think it'd be that hard.
Oh, wow.
Fuck.
That's a 5.
Oof. Roll better.
Wow. Although this is not normally a problem, and you can assure everyone this has never happened to you before. The stone is cold under your touch, and as you sing to it with a memory of the dragon, the stone seems unwilling to remember. and lies quiet.
Yeah. It's weird for a stone to be intransigent, but this one just, it knows something, but it won't.
As if sensing what's happening, I think Kian says, perhaps it's afraid.
Of what? It's a rock.
He says, his voice kind of trembling a little bit, I have a few thoughts. And he begins putting out cards. I'm sure that the ancient script, even though it's different, are the runes on the cards the same as the ancient script, or is this a different script?
So there are two scripts, the ancient script and the modern script.
Right.
So I think the cards actually have both.
Right.
They're kind of a Rosetta Stone, because they're also kind of a wizard teaching tool.
Right, yeah.
Right, and so I think they have both.
Okay. I was going to say, oh, sorry.
But this is a very, it's hard to describe. This is almost like a florid version of the ancient script. Mm-hmm. Like the ancient script is sort of, the modern script is a little bit freehand and kind of flexible. And you've always thought of the ancient script as being like terse, something. Mm. But this has like, and it could just be fragments of darkness, but this writing seems to have like flourishes and accents and thin places and thicker places, like the brushwork of a master. And it makes you wonder if the version of Vokyal, which is the name for the ancient script that you learned, was like the child's version.
Right. Appropriate, since I probably learned it through this teaching tool as a child would. I think I put out cards in the same order as the runes above, and I spell out that word, mm-hmm. which I think I say out loud, warn. But then it's almost as if it's like warn is the skeleton. And then the other cards are coming out to like try to map, like do a sentence diagram of the florid words, and then kind of get the, there's like an added insight or an added connotation, and get that out of it.
I love it. So we're tapping the deck, obviously.
Yep. I think it's connected to an deck outside. The deck speaks to me, connected to an outside intelligence. Letters give voice to the voiceless. Those three.
Okay.
Does anybody have a hurt against me?
I do.
You want to use it?
Sure. Cecile is embarrassed to have you succeed where he failed.
I figured it. Yeah, that makes sense. So I'll take
to have take. To have human magic succeed where certain.
And so John, just so you know, you can't get another plus this session.
I can't get an. Oh, I can't.
You can only get one.
Okay. Well, then in that case, there's no benefit to using the hurt. I mean, you can if you want to, Matthew, but there wouldn't be if you wanted to screw me over. But
that's all right.
save it for a really good occasion.
Yeah, save it for. Save it for when it's really going to twist the knife. Alrighty. Damn.
Whoa.
I think I just solved the mystery.
Dynamite!
Dynamite. That is a critical success.
Here's the answer. You can all go home now.
You realize that written plainly as the nose on your face in the world is the declaration, I am the Hound. And so there's a connection in the ward here to the one that made it. And you think you understand enough that you could use it to connect with the person that made the ward.
And so as, like, it starts off simple, and then, in a gradual way that perhaps doesn't even seem obvious in retrospect, it just begins spiraling out, this kind of diagram, as he's putting out more cards. And more cards are coming out that there couldn't possibly be that many of that card in the deck, if there were the same number of cards for each card. And he's putting out more and more cards. And then he shuffles the deck and spells out like a brand new sentence. And he's trying to make contact. And it's, we're at the ward. I am listening.
There's a moment where the darkness and the light take hands in the room, and then there is a becoming, and the sigils of shadow hanging in the air are drawn forward until an ant shaped like a man, or a man reshaped like an ant, made of shadow, stands with his feet just between the cards. Driglas indeed. Driguna, I would say. He says, your kind of wizard is often called Driglas, which is like a green wizard. Someone that works with like the carvings in the green. But glass is kind of it's a fake green. It's like what you'd call something dyed green rather than the living world. And Una, the word he uses, Una, would be the name of like one of the old masters, would be a Dri Una, like a master of the living green.
And so the sentence he actually said to me was, what did he say?
Master of the artificial living green?
Yeah, he says, Dri Glas, indeed. Dri Una, I would think.
I am connected to one. Says.
Curious.
What were you trying to warn us?
And the shadow unfolds its hand, and there's a lump of clay that he holds out past you.
So he's here?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Cool. Claiborne has been making trips into the root cellar part of this under area.
So somebody, presumably the spinner, like stacked all the dirt and rocks back up and blocked the passage. Did you unblock it?
Oh, really? Oh, that was the passage you were talking about. Yeah. Okay. Well, I was just planning on bringing armloads of celery root and other stored roots out for Sisyphus, and had been spending my time throwing them into his mouth as he caught them like a very large dog.
Well, it was a lovely thought.
Yes.
If you wanted to do that, it wouldn't be hard to. The spinner is not a mason, so. It wouldn't be hard to have cleared the stone and stepped into the room and grabbed things, if you'd like.
Okay, yes, I did do that.
Okay, great.
And then when all of the roots that were going to just rot away or grow or something, wherever they were, do not go to waste. And then I stack things back as the spinner had it. And so, yes, I am available to come forward and take the lump of clay and smack it onto the side of my head, where over the course of the next several hours, it forms itself slowly into a human ear.
I will spare you my commentary. I'm glad you've come. And you look refreshed. That was quite the working. He says, gesturing to the doorway.
I was simply following the breadcrumbs that you laid behind.
Simply. I see. The smile and on the shadow's face is utterly unmistakable.
I think Kian kind of gathers the cards up and almost like in embarrassment hides them into his cloak.
I am gratified that you received my message, he says, not to you, Cliburn, and that you have gathered your companions and returned.
I found myself unable to rest easy with the idea that if I was lost in the dark, that no one would come for me. And so, you see, I had to come.
And I am glad of it. And there is something amiss with those who have gotten lost in the tunnels. Something has been taken from them. Each of them has suffered some physical damage, but it is, I think, only symbolic of some damage within them. It would not surprise me greatly if simple folk, such as they are, could not, did not recognize me as I am, or did not retain memory of me after I had gone. That would be unsurprising to me. But not only does something seem to have been taken from them, but although at times they have been listless, they do not seem present. And several of them have wandered away. And some of them have wandered into the maze, deep in the tunnels, where terror is. And they seem to be up to something.
You could not stop them?
They did not respond to me, and I herded them back to the place I set safe for them, and I warded it as best I could. But they are strange, as I said.
And had the hand of another in this.
Clearly something has been done, but strangely enough, to the limit of the powers here in my shadow, I cannot see what has been done to them, only that it has been done.
Do you have any, indication about whether it was done to them by something or someone recently, or is it an effect of the place that we are in and that they are in?
That I cannot say. It is only, I can see that some change has been wrought, but not how it was done.
Have you felt any change to yourself?
Well, myself and body, which have skipped across the ages like a stone on a pond, as I said, are trapped even now before the doorway of terror. And I have been unable to effect a change in that regard, which I'm surprised by.
I think Kian silently, as he talks, takes the deck back out and begins playing a game of solitaire, except the again, the skeleton is the ward that he used to connect with the hound. Mm-hmm. And he's now, I want to do an investigation like, hey, if you were affected by something, you probably wouldn't know it either. Are you affected by something?
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Beyond what he already knows, that, you know, his body and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. And what are we tapping?
I think the same three.
Okay.
Except actually this time not connected to an outside intelligence. I think it's the letter gives voice to voiceless, the deck speaks to me, and the intelligence outside mortal understanding for this one. Because this feels beyond both of us.
Okay. I think I'm going to tap the weakness. Brooke's not the unclean.
Fair.
So...
So plus two.
But when you roll 12 all the time, that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, well, about that.
All right, 7.
Barely.
Great. So you get 3 questions, and would you like to be exposed to danger or answer a question yourself?
Oh, answer a question myself.
Okay. You have three questions.
First question. Is he under any effects that he's unaware of?
Yes. The hound.
Second question, what are those effects?
He cannot leave this place.
How long has that been active?
Since the empty moon passed the sky last.
As a dree, I think I have some astrology, like just very basic astrology. Like, how long ago would that have been?
The empty moon is erratic and somewhat unpredictable, but also fast. So it could have been, it probably was last night.
I think as he's playing this game, do you want to ask that question now or are you going to wait for a moment?
Oh, I wanted to let you do your...
Yeah, okay. So I think as he's playing the game, he puts the last card down and the cards go poof, and they kind of like jut out from each other. And he's like, oh. And he cleans it up.
And the question, the card's answer is, what part of your magic are you afraid of?
And who's receiving this answer, the hound, or do I not know?
No.
What part of my magic am I afraid of?
Mm-hmm.
that I will be consumed by it, just the way Queen Aya seemed to be consumed by the by her studies. That someday I will be also one of the lost with the Triskerion. What was the name? What was the word for the people who are lost?
The unbound.
The unbound. Yeah.
Okay. You can't help but notice what has happened with the cards, mm-hmm. and you with a chill. You are aware that something here is drinking that in.
And I think the way that plays out is like when it goes poof, the cards rearrange themselves, and possibly some of them are now showing a different face than they were when he put them down. And it says unbound. And you can intervene, but I was thinking the hound might see that, and Kian says, oh, that.
Yes, that.
That is a price, not an answer. You're bound here. And he gathers the cards up and puts them away.
That is concerning. Then it is likely I will not long walk free.
It seemed to have happened, and he kind of moves one card out, and because the cards have many different interpretations, one of the interpretations is the new moon, and it pushes that one out. It seemed to have happened when the new moon, when the empty moon passed last, which it's hard to say, but that might have been last night.
The shade's eyes narrow. Well, ill news indeed. I can lead you to where I have sequestered your wanderers.
I glance over at Claiborne.
Could attempt to bring them here, but I'm uncertain how successful that would be.
We will come.
You will. There are There is something else. There are other things in the tunnels. They have been avoiding me.
What sort of things?
I'm not certain. It could be another person who is perhaps more lost than the ones that I have found. But it could be something else.
If they're avoiding you, I wonder if they're less lost, because the others don't even seem to acknowledge your presence.
Yes, that could be true. He says without a hint that he agrees with you. I do think at one point I heard a sheep.
What?
He shrugs. The spinner on the ceiling manages to look extremely innocent when you look over at it, Claiborne.
Now, I was assuming that since the tack and feed and water was missing, that the livestock had not become spider food. But perhaps that was an incorrect assumption.
Oh, there's a large bundle of something in the web.
Yes. A large bundle of next Wednesday, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Yeah, okay.
Well, here we go.
We all have to eat. And Claiborne walks forward toward the ward. If it's did now the ward, you changed it to your own. Is it still a ward? Can we enter?
It actually bled out of the air and became him.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So there's nothing forward that you see there now.
Okay.
He leads you down into the tunnel that begins to curve slightly and sort of wander back and forth like it was maybe made originally by an underground stream of some kind. Or a back scratcher, perhaps.
I was raising my hand. Claiborne, as we go along, is dragging one of his heels with each step.
Okay.
Leaving a line of mud on the ground where we've been.
Yes. There are obviously like branchings or there are other ways that cross yours or sometimes terminate into yours, but they are rounded and not square as this one is now and very different. And so it feels not so much like a branching, but as other ways coming into this way. If I go slightly this way and go like this. I'll finally be innocent. And at the third opening to the right, the shadow turns into that space. It's obvious and perhaps unsurprising that the shadow doesn't seem to require your light to interact with the dark. And then goes some distance, and there are other passes off to the right and some little alcoves on the left. But at the first actual open space, which is somewhat low and probably is going to need to leave Sisyphus behind. Or he's going to like kind of grind and crunch and bounce and along the way.
Okay.
He turns left. And this path goes maybe 20 paces further on, and then there's just a drop off. And the shadow steps lightly off, sort of holds a hand out like in warning, and just steps off the edge and kind of plummets out of sight. As you approach the edge and the light, perhaps a little grudgingly, moves out before you. You can see that this is a low round place, and there are several hemispherical or there are several half circle tunnels that end into this large room, and then there are some more half circle tunnels on the floor, which is about a span and a half of a man's height down below, that lead out. But the ones leading out are maybe only like a foot and a half high. So a child could take them, but it might be challenging for a man. A smaller woman could probably take them also. The ground here, you can see that you can hear from the shadow's impact, now there's a strange thought, that the ground is quite sandy. And you see several figures, all disturbingly, you see four children and one adult male, and they're all standing with their faces up against the wall.
Oh, shit. Did we just wander into the Blair Witch? Because I'm out.
Yeah. Well, I could make the Jiggly Cam experience for you if that would help.
No, I really wouldn't.
Maybe, but the absence of Jiggly Cam hopefully super annoying main characters would tend to dissuade you from concluding that you're in the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, good.
Also the lack of electricity. Morons. We'll never get out of here if we follow the river. Let's destroy the map. And so the shadow jumps down and walks into the middle of the space and walks over to the figure of the man and sort of kind of pulls on his shoulder. And he sort of leans back and kind of steps unwillingly. And the shadow goes to turn him around, and then forcefully he takes a step forward, and you actually hear a thunk as his head hits the wall. And the shadow turns. They were not quite this way yesterday. They were more aimless. There are handholds carved into the stone below the entrance, so you can descend and reascend easily enough. And the sand is thick and soft if you wanted to jump.
I think I'll climb.
I did create some wardings in this place, and each time I returned, they were gone. And since my shadow's strength is not boundless, I thought it was perhaps a hopeless task at best. So do you make your way down there? Does one of you want to stand up in the hallway for some reason? What do you get up to?
I'm going to try to get down there.
Yeah, Cecile's going to climb.
You do easily enough, however you do.
Do any of the people look familiar?
The children, you're not sure. The man seems quite familiar, and you go over and kind of pull his shoulder away from the wall and look at him and breathe a sigh of disappointment, because it's not Donald, but he looks like Donald.
Wait, do you mean
the same? Sorry,
Daru, or is it, which one was Donald?
I made my NPC notes wrong. Oh, Lord.
We're looking for two men.
He looks a little bit like Daru.
Uh-huh.
But isn't him. He has the same kind of build. His beard is a little shaggy, but sort of done in the same way. And you realize maybe he doesn't look so much like him, but like it's like his body and the haircuts and the beard are all sort of familiar.
Is he wearing any Alay kind of? Does he have a kilt that's identifying or anything like that?
He seems to have lost, possibly because it's one of Paul's games, but he seems to have lost his shirt somewhere along the way. But he is wearing a full kilt, but it's just a sort of, like a kind of a work kilt. So it's not a nice one that would have a tartan. Mm-hmm. It looks old and sort of mended and made of like a kind of a cheap wool. So it's all sort of, there may have been stripes on it at one point, but it's all sort of just like dark brown at this point. You think it's possible that it could be like a very old stained, judging from way the way the thin stripes are, it's possible that it's an Olu tartan, but you couldn't be sure.
So we're looking for Daru and Donal?
Yeah.
And so this might be Donal.
It might be.
Because we've never met Donal.
Claiborne, do you recognize any of the children?
I'm going to pass along to the three children and see if I can recognize their faces.
The first child you kind of pull away from the wall. It's a boy, but something he's either got a disease or he's been bitten by something, because the whole area, like his nose and the whole area around his nose is like swollen and red and angry, and there's kind of some pus running from it.
Mm-hmm.
He might look familiar, but it's hard to be certain. There's a sort of, the next child is sort of straggly, has sort of straggly mid-length brown hair that has curious dents in it at regular intervals, and she looks like she face planted like into sand or something, because her face has a bunch of vertical scratches on it. Mm. Or maybe she walked through brambles or something, but they're vertical, not horizontal, like if you walk through something.
Right.
But based on her hair, you remember one of the girls, one of the city girls, that always had her hair braided. And you think that the kind of curious dents in the hair are from the plaiting.
So it might be unbraided and unwashed since then.
Right.
And does she appear to have any physical damage other than the vertical scratches on her face?
Do you kind of conduct a little examination?
Yes.
There's nothing else super obvious. You conduct an examination, and the last thing you do is you just kind of like, and her two lower canines have been removed.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. I'm going to check the other children.
Open
their mouths.
The boy, he doesn't have his two front teeth, but you can see the stubs of like white adult teeth sort of poking through the gums.
Oh, so that might be a natural loss.
Yeah, you think so, maybe. And then there is a third boy, and you definitely do recognize him. Like he has a little bit of a like a crooked face.
Uh-huh.
Not deformed, but just like one eye is just like a little bit higher than the other. And
yeah.
And like, you know. You note that both of his earlobes are missing. And they've clearly been like cut off.
Oh,
and not with something sharp.
Oh. Is there a lot of blood?
No. There's like there's scabs. The missing points.
Their clothes aren't stained with blood or anything like that.
No, their clothes are stained, but not especially with blood. No, so it's not like blood poured out. You would also know. I mean, like piercings and things are common, very common, and like your ears don't tend to bleed that much.
Have during this entire time, have any of them said anything?
No.
Or done anything?
The children, as you pulled them away from the wall to investigate, they've just kind of stayed standing there.
Oh, they don't replant into the wall?
No.
Oh. Almost as if the man has been given something to do. What happens if we move him out into an open space where he's not facing a wall?
He is resistant to moving away from the wall, and he has the build of a barley eater.
Mm-hmm.
He has the thick build of a man who has done serious labor and serious violence. And he resists, but it's not beyond you to compel him. The resistance seems a little autonomic.
Mm-hmm.
So you sort of pull and push and turn him into the middle of the space. And he's once you stop kind of fighting with him, he sort of rocks in place. And his eyes are sort of fixed. And open, and he sort of rocks in place and then stops and turns his head as though listening and then turns back toward that area where he was standing and begins walking with increasing speed in that direction.
We should follow him.
Is he...
Whereupon he smacks into the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
I think I turn to Cecile and I say, I don't know how you did it, but I didn't expect us to be able to communicate with the spinner. Is there a way which you can do that for us now? With these people.
Yes, I'm a little bit worried about what else would be in the conversation. It would be easier if you came with me.
Well, I'm here with you now.
No, I mean deeper. Partially into the mind.
If I can help, of course.
Is all this right.
Some Surin magic?
It is.
I would like to see it.
It's less of a seeing and more of a... Well. So the man is still kind of like head first into the wall.
Yeah. There's maybe a little blood trickling down his face now. When he smacked his forehead into the stone.
When he smacked his forehead into the stone, did that look deliberate or did it look like I'm moving and oh, there's a thing there?
Yeah, the second. Like someone head down, determined to get somewhere, and then shocked by running into a rock.
Hmm.
One question. Are they all facing the same direction?
They weren't. They were all kind of on that side of the room.
Uh-huh.
But no.
Okay.
Okay. So yeah, he's going to use the dead dream in the waking world.
Fun.
and of one mind, because while he is physically separated from Sisyphus, I think he can still kind of pull him into this.
Sure.
And then I think the dragon's children command respect. That there's a little less resistance.
Tell me about that one.
So I think the big thing is that ultimately, because he's using the power of the dragon in this capacity, there's a little bit of respect that he is something of the dragon. So it's not just him doing it, but it's him sort of serving as that. So I think ultimately, if there was something regarding like the serpent or like one of the human gods, that might actually be a hindrance because he's sort of broadcasting who he is and what he represents. But otherwise, I think it would be a benefit, this idea that he kind of has this power and prestige behind him. He's channeling a little bit of the dragon as well. Or what was the dragon?
Yes. Would you like a help or a hurt or both? Can I do both? I can...
No, just one.
You have to pick one.
Would you like a help or a hurt?
Do those make narrative sense to you?
Absolutely. You asked me for help.
Okay, sure. How about a help?
Okay. And the hurt also, if you wanted that, like the serpent and the dragon are our enemies.
Right. So let's do the help. That'll be kind of fun.
Cool.
And how does the help take form?
So I think ultimately he's going to pull in Keegan with him. So, Kian. So Kian's presence is there that's sort of supporting him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think
are you drawing Claiborne in too?
If Claiborne is willing.
I think that our recent magical connection may make that possible. Yes.
Awesome. Lovely. The lovers, the Clayman and me.
So John, how does Kian's aid take shape?
I think.
What form does it take?
I think as Cecile kind of pulls him along with him, Kian looks into the man's eyes and there's sort of like his expression sort of kind of mirrors the man. And I think he's kind of offering himself as kind of a conduit. Like a sort of a like a willing mirror, so that Cecile can kind of like more, because these people are kind of in a fugue state, but Kian isn't, and so by mirroring them, Kian can actually communicate for them.
Kind of bridge the space. Yeah. Great. And so, do you touch them, or do you how do you include them in your connection to the dragon's dreaming, the dead dragon's dreaming?
So I think
you ask your ancestors to intervene.
So I think first he kind of touches. He takes like just a little bit of soil. And he sort of just paints it on the man's face. And then does the same with Keegan. And then does the same with Claiborne. And then he like sits down. And he kind of motions you guys to sit. or lay down, and then he kind of goes into this meditative state. And he reaches out and he tries to connect with the sort of throb of the earth, what he thinks of as the dreams of the dragon. And then he sort of makes a motion and sort of tries to pull everybody's consciousness down into sort of the shared space below them.
Can I do something?
Absolutely.
So when everyone closes their eyes, they realize that they are in a vast, vast dark emptiness on a smooth clay floor. And the smooth clay floor, it seems to be a sort of a disc, maybe 100 feet across, and with vast curling pillars coming up around it. And then you realize you are in the palm of a clay hand. And in the distance, in the darkness, you see an enormous monolithic clayborn. You are in the palm of his right hand, and the palm of his other hand, there are 4 people, one of them taller than the other 3. And the hands are coming together to hold the group together in place. And Claiborne looks down at you calmly.
Begin screaming. Just kidding.
I think also Cecile looks bigger in this. His legs are not stunted in the streaming world. And also we talked a little bit about how his growth had been a bit retarded, that he should look more adult and be bigger than he is. And in this state, he has more of that. He looks about man-sized. It's a little bit thicker.
Here in this lit darkness, you are not alone. The man is here and the children are here. And as perhaps has happened to you in the past, they are walking. The children somewhat exhaustedly, and the man is trying to run. But the clay of these great hands below their feet is gormless and sticky and cloying, and for every step they take, they seem to only sink further into it, or it barely lets go of them before grabbing them again and dragging them backward. And so they seem doggedly to be going forward. And they are not alone. There is a hummingbird with a thorax of pure gleaming gold and a forehead of brilliant red and gold iridescence. And its wings, they must be its wings, are also gold, but in the way of a hummingbird's wings, they're moving both too swiftly and also standing in place. And so each of the hummingbirds is surrounded by a circle almost of golden leaves that also are a blur of gold around them. And they're, each of them, each of the figures has before it a golden red crested hummingbird with its circle, with its encircling blur of golden wings. and they're cheap. They have a piercing, occasional sort of peep or cry that they emit whenever the person walking seems to be faltering in their step. And as you see them tire, a tattered shadow passes overhead. And you look up and you see that circling high overhead against a distant gray glare of empty sky, there are the tattered winged shapes of vultures circling. But you can tell from here that although they have the wings, the tattered wings of vultures, and the ugly mottled necks and faces of vultures, they have the bodies of men. And they're circling up above and occasionally dipping down and rising back to circle. As yet, the hummingbirds and the vultures do not seem aware of you, or they have not acknowledged your presence.
How many of each are there?
There's one hummingbird for each of the four. And there are, you think, three circling vultures. There is something very familiar going on.
Are the hummingbirds the sign of any deities or powers that we know of?
Well, the Night Lodge had a pair of like nature gods that were brother and sister and lovers that took many shapes, some of which were birds. But they were more like blood and horn and bone and raven and you don't have any sense of that.
Okay. So I think because we're in like a dream state, things can kind of shift. Sure. And that way, like you look over at someone and then all of a sudden, like you're face to face kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think what Cecile's going to try and do is, he kind of like moves a rock so that one of the people stumbles.
A rock?
Kind of. Yeah.
Cool.
Just that they kind of kick a rock or whatever and they kind of stumble. And then shifts so that they're he and Kian are kind of there. It kind of interrupted one person's and presumably one.
Well, I mean, they're like struggling and staggering and rising and, you know,
right.
Sort of like mired in the clay and kind of struggling free of the clay and then sort of being sucked back into it.
Yeah, so kind of cutting one off to see if we can talk to them.
Cutting one off from what?
Just the other four.
They're not humans. Huddled together.
Okay. Can you hear us? Either of you.
So do you just step into his field of, are you just in, who are you picking, first of all?
Let's do the man.
Okay. And are you stepping into his field of view? Are you stepping between him and the hummingbird? Are you directly behind the hummingbird? Are you?
Originally, like, right in front of him, like his field of view. How far ahead is the hummingbird in front of him?
Maybe just at arm's length.
Okay.
It's sort of in the way of hummingbirds. It's sort of hovering and adjusting.
Since I'm in this dream, I have an idea. Can I share? And either of you can. I don't know if it's. Is that okay? Yeah. I think that the maybe Donal is, you know, struggling and like just in this constant, you know, struggle. And Kian, when he entered into the dream state, unlike the other people, because he's offered himself for a purpose, looks a lot like Claiborne in the sense that he's offered himself as a canvas. And so even though his body and face are familiar and they're Kian's, there's a certain impermanence and a certain blandness and a certain just genericness to his form. And when he's in the dream, his body's completely motionless. And then in the way of dreams, how like one reality is kind of superseded by another reality, the figure of Donal struggling like slows down and then becomes like stationary. Mm-hmm. And Kian is not moving around, but on his face is the face of struggling. Like all the physical actions that the Donal was doing, even though Kian's standing stock still, all those physical exertions and emotions are being like radiating on his face and his body.
Nice.
And you know, the idea being that you could address Kian, like you're talking to him through Kian.
Okay. Yeah, he will. Can you hear me?
Who's there?
A friend, if you'll have him.
I can't see you.
Where it's dark.
You? All four of the hummingbirds, the zzzz of their wings grows louder, and all four of them simultaneously go, really sort of a piercing loudness.
Is it like one or is it continuous?
No, it's just one sort of tee.
Oh yeah.
Very, very high pitched and very loud.
I'm not sure exactly where I am. Do you know where you are?
Yes, I'm lost.
And yet you seem to be headed in a certain direction and working very hard towards that. Where are you going?
I'm trying to find my daughter, who is a witch.
And she's in this direction. How do you know that?
I have to get out. I have to find my daughter. There's only... It's so dark. And there's just one little strip of light.
And you're headed towards the light.
I think it's sunlight. It's cold.
Got the wings of the hummingbirds.
And it's not
one of the vultures departs from the other two and begins a wide gyre downward toward the clay plain.
That's not sunlight, friend. I can help you find your way out, and perhaps I can help you find your daughter. Will you trust me?
Perhaps it's a candle then. It's in the dawn. I saw the dawn. Goes the vulture.
I can help you, but you have to trust me.
Did Gwyn send you?
In a manner of speaking. If you keep stumbling, you won't find...
Is the baby all right? I couldn't get to them.
The baby is all right. I can take you to her. But you have to do what I... You have to follow me, all right?
I can't get out. There isn't a way out.
There is. But you can't keep struggling. You have to close your eyes. You have to rest.
No. I can't close my eyes.
Then you won't see your daughter again.
If I close my eyes, I'll die. If I stop here, I'll die.
Is there a way I can determine if that's actually true?
Hopefully, the vulture lands nearby. And the man's body crouches down and takes a couple of very human but very vulturous, hopeful hops forward. And as it bats at you again, you see very disturbingly that inside the vulture's beak are human teeth. Not like crunched up, but like...
Right. Cecile says...
And does this vulture also have earlobes?
No. Sorry, I just switched headsets. The charge ran up on this. Mm-hmm. I've been on them all day.
Greetings. And what brings you here?
It sort of narrows its ugly turkey brows at you and looks at him and kind of nods the beak hopefully at him.
No. This one's not finished.
The turkey neck is able to turn the head much farther than a human head, and it turns its head to look at you differently.
Yeah.
And then looks back.
If you're looking for meat, you should try elsewhere.
It says agreeably.
Okay.
Just, but sits there.
Okay. Patient.
The other two vultures have kind of spread out and their circle is much more slowly descending, but together they are descending.
So I was also kind of addressing John's body. So I want to kind of talk to Kian as well and okay. ask if you feel the man is in danger if he stops.
You feel that he feels that if he closes his eyes, that behind his eyes there is something so awful he will not survive it. And that if he stops, he'll just be swallowed up.
I think Kian's body, which was playing everything the man was feeling and saying, all of a sudden goes completely motionless, and the voice of Kian comes out, but it's kind of monotone. I think he is running, and if he does stop, he will perish.
In truth, or in his mind?
I can only feel what is in his mind. But I believe that the thing he's running from, it feels real to me.
As I see it, we have two options. We can either try and pull him out of the dreaming with us and back to his body, but we'd have to convince him. Otherwise, it's unlikely to go well. Or we can follow them and see if we can find the destination. Both have hazards.
Can we render him unconscious? Can we render them unconscious? How long, out of character, how long was the trip here from where we were upstairs?
Maybe half an hour.
It would be a lot of work, but if we could put them to sleep, perhaps we could move them. But then I don't know if the thing they are running from will claim them.
Nor do I.
The hummingbird that has been all this time in front of the man darts suddenly up into the air and over directly in front of you, Cecile.
Greetings, I was hoping you'd come.
And it berates you with a series of intense chirps. And moves itself in a square like it's boxing in your head. And then darts back to the center and sort of darts forward and back like in an obvious threat. And then it...
Do I understand any of it? Serena, I think, are a little bit closer to the animal world, so they might be able to pick up a little bit more.
There's something too alien about it.
So it feels less like a hummingbird and more like a manifestation of something else.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that would be out of the Serena's wheelhouse.
But that the chirping was angry at you and like cussing you out was unmistakable.
Yeah. Right.
And that the last dart forward and back was a threat was also unmistakable. And then it sort of back over. And as you look back, Kian having stopped and the man having stopped, he's literally sinking into the muck that is Claiborne's hands. They're only mucky in that one little part. It's not you. You're fine.
You're pretty as ever. Can I have some agency in that?
The muck is not really you.
I'm just providing a location. That's something that's happening to them.
Yes.
Okay, so it's sounding like...
So if you would like to alter this portion of the dragon's dream, which includes them, you could certainly spend, Dale, you could certainly spend the juice and use your power however you like.
I'm thinking like the muck isn't you, but that doesn't mean that you can't do something to them to get them out of the muck.
Yeah. The other thing we could do is if we can't take them then, and we're not, if we're kind of resigned to them getting to their destination, we could maybe use the dreaming and sort of tesseract them to the destination.
We don't know where that is.
We don't. That's why we would do it. We would see it.
But I have stepped into this dream as a location.
Mm-hmm.
So my dream juice is going to ask their dream what their destination is.
Nice.
Come back.
Can I add something? Can Dale, do you think Claiborne might like reach out, kind of like subconsciously knowing where the destination is, and then the fingers stopping like just short? So that it's
Actually carry them to it with my hands?
Well, the idea that it's a dream, so like the destination, there's like some sort of destination just beyond like your vision. And like your hand approaches it, but the fingers stop short. So the fingers are like here, and we kind of see the destination like just out of reach. And it kind of compels, it's like, you know, where are you going? So I
what
can
say you, it. Mr. Stafford?
Right.
Does this sound plausible?
I love it. Tell me what happens.
I believe that I'm sure you've had this experience of walking through a darkened room, and when you reach a certain angle, you suddenly can see a shaft of moonlight that was not visible before. I think I am walking through a great dark room with my hands held together before me. And I seem to reach a certain angle where suddenly a shaft of golden sunlight is visible and I can walk toward it.
Great. So the most curious thing happens. Light rises. Your hands seem to grow and contract at the same time. And two different directions are pulled together that had been apart. And as the light grows and becomes clearer, you see that it is the unrelieved glare of wakened builder stone, that unrevealing blue-white radiance that illuminates itself and nothing else. And there seems to be almost, and there is a half circle of blue white builder stone burning there like moonlight. And but the half circle is filled like a rare piece of silvered glass, so that the air above it is made of living blue light, freed from the stone, and it shimmers like liquid and seems to lead somewhere else. But the other thing that has been pulled into this place before the light is a great black knotwork in the form of a circle with much like a hyper complex version of the four knots that represent the five kingdoms. Alay being left out because, you know. And it stands free in the air in front of the light, unilluminated, and perhaps unsurprisingly, by the builder light that dispels no shadows. But the middle of the knot, which represents perhaps the union of kingdoms or the union of the elements of the world, seems to be sort of sucking forward, like it's being pulled and distended out of shape. And you realize that the knotwork is trying to become a mouth that's trying to open. And you certainly know, Claiborne, that it wants to eat them.
Hmm.
Is that where they're headed, or are they headed towards the door?
So they, so he at least thinks he's trying to get to the light of the portal.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's actually headed toward is that the black mouth of the knotwork. Hmm. And give me just 1 second. And with his goal so near, the man begins to free himself from the muck. And frantically, the hummingbird moves to the side and begins chirping at the man, and sort of moving its body back and forth so that the iridescence of its throat and crown kind of gleam and flash in the blue white light of the builder stone and whatever distant light is illuminating it. And you see flashes of gold so that its circling wings look more like leaves spinning than wings, and you see the man's attention is kind of stops in his struggles and turns and looks at the hummingbird, and the hummingbird turns away in the circle and seems to be drawing the man away from the diagram.
From the knotwork?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good.
And in smaller fashion, the children seem to gain renewed purpose and struggle out of the muck, and their hummingbirds have harried them. For some reason, the hummingbirds don't seem afraid to touch the children. And so the hummingbirds have come and kind of batted against their cheeks and then flittered away and are more easily leading the kids.
Are the children easier to recognize in this, because they were a little bit deformed?
Yeah.
These are their dream states.
Yeah, they look like normal kids.
Okay, but we don't really recognize them?
Claiborne recognizes them.
Okay.
I think as the separation is complete and Kian returns to being Kian, mm-hmm. He kind of takes more solid form. This is linked to the terror that we disturbed at the lake.
The knotwork is?
Yes.
Then is it of the serpent?
No. The hummingbirds, I think, are an aspect of Turner.
As you say that, all four of them freeze in place. And you can see now they're not hummingbirds at all, but they're like gold in the shape of hummingbirds with leaves hanging by tiny filaments around them.
Turner was the smith god, right?
This is a spinner of prophecy.
Oh, right.
Are the hummingbirds paying attention to us now?
They've just like turned into, they've stopped being alive.
Oh.
When you said Turner, they immediately just became like effigies hanging in the air.
Shit. Or perhaps like wind toys.
And all four figures sort of stop and kind of look around, and then all four of them turn toward the light and the diagram, and they begin walking in that direction, and the ground no longer impedes them.
The light being the sort of lit corridor?
The builder stone with the black knotwork that's struggling to open itself like a mouth.
Oh no, we can't let that. Claiborne, can you stop them?
I believe that when I brought my palms together, I believe that I believe that you joined the others on my other palm. And so that leaves one hand free to form a wall.
Thank you, Claiborne. Gian?
So you try to pull your hands together and slide one hand in to block the light and the shadow. And I'm going to need you to go toe-to-toe.
Okay.
Because the light and the shadow resist.
Mm-hmm.
Shocking. Shocking. Surprisingly.
Oh.
And so what tags would you like to use?
Grounded.
Okay.
And from an emotional, spiritual standpoint, I know it when I see it.
Okay. I'm going to invoke your weakness. I'm new to this.
What about plot twists?
That's true. Plot twist is a reformation of the landscape. And that's what I am right now.
Great.
Yeah.
That's plus three, minus one.
And then I'm going to, Claiborne, do you want me to use my help? Give you the help?
Yes. I think you should be the, well, what you've been the whole time, which is the voice of reason.
I think the way that help takes form is that Kian can't, when he says the word Turner, the hummingbirds freeze and are no longer hummingbirds. And the last words you hear him say is, "Oh God, what have I done?" And then he freezes, or at least his face does. And so he begins throwing cards out, which the cards just appear in his hand, and he's throwing them ahead, like trying to throw them ahead of each person, even though he can't move from where he's at. Mm. And each card is landing on parts of the hand that Clayboard is holding them on, and is like creating the like from the card images kind of spiral out like obstacles, trying to like shepherd them. That might be a little bit more than what a help could be, but I don't know.
We're in a dream state.
Yeah. I mean, I could, I don't know if you said go toe to toe, so I don't know if I can actually even do a full on, you know, attack thing here.
You, if that's what you'd rather do, you can. Or you can just help his action.
I think I just want to help.
Okay. Yeah, that's great then. That's, yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I love it. Cool. Great. Cool.
Plus three.
Great. All right. So you've got your plus three. Mm-hmm. Dale, so it's 2d6 plus three.
Yes. I already rolled that.
Oh, you already rolled. Okay. Oh, yay. 9. Alrighty.
So success with complications.
Yes.
I believe.
So you are finding it impossible, like your hands have kind of bonded together as you held them together, and you kind of winch them apart, and you manage to bring your fingers down well before the figures. And their trod seems to be slowing down. But the light and the shadow are cut off for a long, hot moment. And the figures seem to be slowed by the strange ink-like manifestations from the cards. And so the three children especially seem kind of lost. And the man slows down and seems to be like looking again for the light. The two of you, but especially Cecile, especially you, you see the shadow of the knotwork begin to bleed through the back of Claiborne's hand.
Can I try and reactivate the hummingbirds?
Absolutely. How would you like to do that?
Well, first he's shouting Turner at them because that's what broke them in the first place. I don't imagine that's actually working.
So you shout Turner, and the vulture man claps his hands over his ears, and like leaps away back into the air.
Okay. But I'm getting nothing. So he's shouting it like a couple times as he runs up to these things and getting no response.
Right.
So when he gets right up to them, what does he see beyond what he's seen?
So they have in fact basically become, they've turned into like wind toys. Or not toys, but wind sculptures. And so that you can see a very slender a line of gold that connects them to the flesh of Claiborne's palm, and then there are there's a spindle that runs through the center of the hummingbird's body, and it's sort of flat and turned to the side, you know.
Okay.
And then there are slender, almost leaf-like or branch-like spun pieces of gold that hold a circle of what are leaves, a gold hammered gold leaves, and it looks. It occurs to you as you get close to it, it looks functional.
Okay, he's going to pick up one of them and then sort of gently...
It's like rooted to the earth somehow, even by that just slender descent of gold.
Fine, he will kind of kneel down with all the symbology of that. And then he's going to gently, kind of lovingly blow and try and get it spinning.
You can feel the way that your breath is not enough.
Hmm.
But that the dragon's breath would be enough.
All right. So, yeah, we're going to use that then. Well, it's going to look at the tags again really quick. Sorry. My mouse is.
I can type it for you, but then I'd feel responsible.
I'm thinking dragon strength. And the dragon's children respect, because I think it's another one of the powers. And then I think I still kind of think that the dead dream, or the idea of the dead dream and the waking world, this idea that he's in this dream and he can kind of take the strength in with him.
Okay.
Okay.
Can I suggest something?
Sure.
Given that you knelt and given all of us here what we're doing, I think the crew tag "we are all servants" applies.
Hmm.
And that you're trying to wake a god.
Yeah. Yeah, that might be better than the last one.
No, a crew tag I think you can use in addition, right?
Yeah, you can add a crew tag as a fourth one. I love it.
Okay, so that would be a 9 then.
Oh, all right.
So can I narrate this a little bit?
Oh, sure.
So I think he goes, and I think there's a moment where it looks like his face elongates a little bit. And there's a moment where you see he looks a lot more like Sisyphus. And if anyone looks at him, you actually see what he might look like as an old Surin, as he returns to the earth, kind of a Surin in their final moments as they sort of return to the dragon and kind of fulfill their destiny. And then he blows. And it's not just air, but there's actually like physical little pieces of earth that come out, because the dragon is not a creature of just breath, but of pressure and of force and not just of like the storm of the earthquake of like a storm, but like an earthquake that just will push through like the place of least resistance. And that's what kind of comes out. And he goes back side to side and tries to sort of blow in a line each of the four hummingbirds.
Slowly at first, filled with reluctance, and the air so full of ending that you find you can hardly stand it. the leaves begin to move and the spindle begins to turn. But it's clear that they won't be hummingbirds again. That the dragon's breath is changing them. That the dragon's breath is making them part of its dream, which is the final sleep, which is death. And so, with a whine, the leaves begin to spin, and the hummingbirds rattle in their places, and the spindles smoke from friction. And they begin to spin faster and faster with the dragon's breath, and then they begin to fly apart. Pieces of them winging out and away, pieces of them falling into the earth that is Claiborne's hands, and pieces of them ground down begin to sparkle outward and cover the sort of baffled faces of the man and the children. And then, for the four hummingbirds, there is no more center. And they're motes of light streaking through the air, like stars held too long away from the sky. And the light expands. And the man and the three children seem covered in gold dust. And a little sharp point, like the beak of a hummingbird, flies directly away from the figures and pierces quite through the dark little knot, trying to come undone. The center of the diagram of terror, and it folds into itself, falling back through Claiborne's flesh. And then there are holes in everything, and there is a light everywhere. And then the world comes apart. And we'll stop there.
Nice.
This has been episode 12 of A Marriage of Serpents. And today was thunder. Well, in our post-consideration, lavishing love upon your fellow players and appreciating their works and deeds.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you for being scenery, Dale. It's the best scenery I've ever seen.
Yeah, I don't even know where to begin because there are so many great moments, like Claiborne and as the taking the landscape. Like, I loved finding out that he was huge, and we were all just standing in his hands. And you know, just the idea of doing that dream on Cecile's part to pull them in. Mm-hmm. So many other things too.
Yeah. So really appreciated Keegan kind of being the conduit for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Using kind of his body as a simulacrum. Because so it was not to distract the others, but to sort of get a couple words in edgewise.
Almost as if a wizard of language might be turning himself into a translation. Mm-hmm. That was fucking cool.
Yeah.
Both of you, the way you saw through into the emotional truth of dreams and found ways to work within that was beautiful.
Yeah.
Huge kudos all around.
Thanks for Paul for giving NPCs, even little automatons, a fair amount of personality.
Yeah. What a setting.
I've played other games with you, and I've noticed that sometimes you're at your best when you have a small, indignant creature. They seem to populate all your games, and I think for good reason, because they're always kind of fun. This like little thing, it's like, no, like, you listen up. I've got a job to do. Whether
perhaps they're in my games because they live in my heart.
Yeah. Yep. Or I remember fat pigeons.
I was going to say my favorite was the fat pigeons. Against the light, contrary wind.
There's something in your soul that kind of reaches out for these creatures, and I appreciate that, Paul. And I appreciate Claiborne kind of being the glue that holds everything together and getting our party back together.
It's a lovely metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I guess with a clay, maybe mortar would be a better word. Mortar.
Did any of that feel like a help or a hurt?
I could see having a hurt towards Claiborne. Because I feel like I brought him into this dream and I didn't know what that would do to him. And while I think he's fine, I think I put him in danger.
So you think he would have a hurt toward you?
I don't feel that.
I kind of thought it was maybe the other way, that maybe Cecile didn't take into account his nature and potentially put him in harm's way. But I'm not wedded to that. That was just an idea that occurred.
I think from Claiborne's point of view, walking and working within dreams is, as Paul pointed out, I'm new to this. Mm-hmm. And I think inviting him into that allowed him to show a part of himself that the player has been wanting to work into this tapestry since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. I'm happy with the help point. It feels We've like been a using a lot of help points this session, so getting more back would also be good.
Yeah, I'm
mechanics
I'm
wise.
I'm glad I got finally a chance to burn a few because I was kind of stockpiling a bunch of them inadvertently.
Yeah,
I would like to maybe. I think it makes sense for me to maybe take a help point towards Claiborne, and my reasoning is that I really liked that up till now it was always you are important and I will follow you. And this is the first time Claiborne was like, you are important, you will follow me.
Right.
And Kian kind of like a little grudgingly was like, yeah. Fair. It's time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like I feel like I have a help point towards Claiborne. I owe you that.
Nice. <Cool.
laughs> Claiborne's calling us in a solid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then to turn around what you said earlier, Matthew, is it possible that Cecile feels like he unwittingly drew Claiborne in and maybe exposed him to danger? And so maybe he has a help toward Claiborne?
Yeah.
Like a little bit of a like, ooh, sorry.
Yeah.
That could have been bad.
Yeah.
Also, I wouldn't fault you if you took a hurt point towards Kian for making the hummingbirds stop.
I don't feel that directly hit. Keegan, though. And also, you're the one who said the word. You're the one who kind of invoked the name that did stop them.
Right. Yes. In other words, it was my fault. And
right.
therefore, I could see you being like, you know, like that's a point of animosity on your end.
No, I don't think so, though. Fair because enough. I don't think he didn't know that would work either. And he was obviously at that point. And this was kind of a fun session because I think we got to see Cecile kind of take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the points where he turned to Key and said, this is more your wheelhouse and your wisdom. What do you think we should do in this? And then there were the other points when he turned to kind of Claiborne and it's like, are you capable of this kind of physically? And so that was kind of fun. I felt like all the party members were needed and our unique skills were all required.
I don't know. Let's find out.
as a point from earlier about like things we liked, I really liked Cecil. I feel like is really maturing over the course of this story. Like this, the Cecil in this chapter felt he felt like he's becoming more of an adult than the Cecil of in the past.
That doesn't mean he's going to stop asking probing questions.
Oh, of course not.
I think he is coming a little bit more into himself. So
yeah.
Maybe a little bit more confident.
Finding agency.
Yeah. Totally.
So the situation with the hummingbirds and Turner. I think, so saying that name and causing them to stop and freeze and change, that in a way is the only thing that finally gave us an insight into their nature, which allowed them to be used to solve a problem. Whereas before that they were attempting and failing. So it might have felt like a mistake and a problem at the time, but it seems to me that the solution was held within that very change.
I think we'll find out next session
whether that's true or not.
I certainly hope so.
Oh, now that's creepy.
Having started the zombie plague, they quickly left town.
I mean, as far as mistakes go, that felt like a very Kian mistake, where he's like, I've learned a thing, and I'm going to share this thing. Fuck. should have just kept that in my quiet voice.
Well, this is a dark Celtic story, so. Yeah. Some of that is inevitable. Well, I am so grateful to be playing with you all, and I am really moved by the loving engagement that you have, not only with the unique characters that you've brought into the game, but the way that you are moving through them to engage the story, as weird and complicated as it might be at times.
So. We appreciate you, Paul. Thank you.
I'm loving the story. I'm enjoying it.
And I think possibly this would be the recording of an episode that I would point my friends to when they say, what are your games like? Because if I think the general public, if they were to watch and listen to this, would be like, holy fuck. Because that was cool.
Cool. Yeah. That's good. That's good to know.
Cool. I agree with that. Around. Yeah.